Baby gorilla in the mist. I'm not going to be all wah, wah about it, but after my stay in rehab in November 1996, following my suicide attempt and then my arrest, I was deeply depressed. I'm sure what contributed to that was my stay in the psych ward at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in Manhattan. If you've never been there and never heard of it, trust me, it's a big deal. The fact that I'd fucked up so badly right when I had so much going for me really weighed heavily on my mind. Being sober and facing things for the first time was incredibly hard for a guy who buffered anything difficult that ever happened in his life with lots of alcohol and drugs. I returned to my mom's house in New Jersey and immediately locked myself in the basement and became bedridden with depression. I slept about 18 hours a day and felt like my life was over. The only thing I did regularly was go see the shrink that the Mad TV producers and Quincy Jones had recommended. Dr. Hugh Butts, whose office is on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. He is a great, great doctor, and he did the best he could with me. I trusted him. So on his suggestion, I checked into the psych ward and spent the Christmas season and the first few weeks of January 1997 there. It was, hands down, the most depressing period of my life. I had my own room and my own toilet, but I shared a common shower with other people on the floor. My room actually had a great view of the George Washington Bridge, but I didn't care. The only thing I looked forward to was nighttime, when I was allowed to take a couple of Ambien to get to sleep. All I wanted was that little high I'd get from those pills before I crashed. They woke us up at 7 a.m. The first person I'd see was an orderly, a black guy with a speech impediment. Every day he'd come into my room and say, "Artie, breakfast." But the way he said it, it sounded like, "Ari, breath fresh." I always got a kick out of that. Mostly I played Scrabble with people who looked like they just committed mass murder, which was very intimidating. You try telling a kid from the South Bronx with severe anger issues that the word mother isn't spelled M-U-T-H-A. If you find yourself in that situation, take my advice. Give him his triple word score, smile, and wait for group therapy to start. I was in there for 10 days with a one-day break for Christmas dinner when I was released into custody of my mother and sister for 3 hours. We ate at my Uncle Tommy's, and that was really depressing. My mother and sister came to pick me up at the hospital, and they stood by the window trying to make the best of the situation by observing how nice and relaxing it was to look out at the water. But we weren't alone. A nurse and a doctor were required to be there to watch me as I shaved. I'd once tried to commit suicide, so I was on suicide watch and could not be left unattended with so much as a safety razor in my hand. That was too much for my mother, and who could blame her? It was Christmas, and she was picking up her son from the psych ward. My mom is stoic, and she'd been strong through a lot over the years, but this was too much. She burst out crying, and a second later, so did I. In January, I was returned to my family's custody. I locked myself back in the basement, crippled with clinical depression. Anyone who has suffered from it or is familiar with it knows it can incapacitate you mentally and even physically. In my case, I literally could not move. My depression felt like a wet blanket over me, keeping me from getting out of bed. This was the second time I'd been through this in 2 years, the first time being the period leading up to my suicide attempt. Looking back a year later, I could see that I was definitely clinically depressed. I just self-medicated myself with mountains of coke. This time, I had nothing holding the depression in check, and I couldn't handle it at all. For the next 2 months, I gave my mother every excuse in the world about why I could not get out of bed, could not get to the shrink, could not go back to rehab, or do a stay in the psych ward. I couldn't cope with any contact, however small, with the outside world. Some friends who had known me forever tried to see me because, like my family, they were worried about me. I told my mother to send them all away. I wasn't doing much to help myself because I also refused to take my prescribed medication. I'd taken the antidepressant Paxil during my last few weeks with Dr. Butts. I'd taken it the year before, and it had helped me. But like everything else in my life, I just dropped it. After a few weeks of lying there in a stupor, I finally just got sick of being that way. Without drugs or anything else helping me, I woke up one day and suddenly I fucking had it. All the things I berated myself for, the suicide attempt, ruining my career, hurting my family, none of it was going to be made better by staying in bed. I had to make it better through action. The line from The Shawshank Redemption came to mind that day and never left. Either get busy living or get busy dying. I picked the first one. I got myself into New York City to see my manager, Peter Principato, after I rejoined the living. He had been my commercial agent at William Morris for a couple years in the early 90s. Unfortunately, drugs destroyed my relationship with him. But Peter always believed in me, and years later, when I left Mad TV, Peter asked me to be his first client after he left the agency to become a manager. I will always be grateful to Peter for that. We're not together anymore, but Peter is a good guy and there's nothing I wouldn't do for him. Sitting in Peter's office back in March 1997, I got the bright idea that we should call Mad TV producers Fax Barr and Adam Small and beg them to let me come back on the show. I was in no condition to attend a matinee of Bambi, let alone get back to work doing sketch comedy. But Peter was wise enough and knew me well enough to make that call. It was a bridge I had to cross. We got on a conference call with them and he sat there listening as I shamelessly begged them to let me come back to finish the last episodes of season 2. I promised them that I'd kick ass like I've done before. I promised them that my drug problems were behind me, and I swore up and down that they never have to worry about my mental health again. I told them all the things I've been doing to get back on track. I told them about the psych ward, and I assured them that all I needed to do to get on my feet was to work again. "Art, we love you," Fax said. "And for that reason, we have to insist that you go through the formal rehab. You've gotten through the depression, but you've got to put your demons behind you." They were right, of course, and they stayed on the phone with me for hours until I finally agreed with them. Once we hung up, I had Peter make arrangements to get me into rehab. We settled on a place my mother knew of in New Jersey called Honesty House, which boasted a very high success rate and handled a lot of celebrity clients. My mother's boss of 20 years, Joel Goldberg, ran a company that did psychological profiles for large corporations, including the New Jersey Nets and the New York Giants. He was always a great help to our family and very, very generous with us after my father fell. Joel made some calls and got me in the Honesty House right away. I was much more open to the process than I had been before, but my goal still wasn't getting well. I was just hoping that after a few weeks, I'd get a good report card from these people and I'd be able to make it to Mad TV and get my job back. Coming out of that deep depression made me feel like a bear coming out of hibernation. It was early spring and starting to warm up, and I felt like I was emerging from a long, dark sleep. My schedule at Honesty House was group therapy for 4 nights a week from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., and one-on-one therapy once a week with Kevin, our group leader. Kevin was an older guy who had been clean and sober for 35 years, and believed completely in the Alcoholics Anonymous 12-step program. I followed the steps diligently for 2 straight months and did all the group sessions. All in all, I got a lot out of it. Then I got to the step where you have to write a note to your drug of choice that ruined your life and basically tell it goodbye. You're supposed to think of it as another human being you have wronged. This is where the process broke down for me because I couldn't keep a straight face, sitting there writing a letter to cocaine. In the end, here's what I came up with. "Dear Cocaine, you are the guy that I love to hang with, and we had a lot of fun together, but you lied to me quite a bit. You told me that I could stay up for 5 straight days with no problem. You told me that I was way more interesting when I hung with you, and that everyone around me liked to hear me talk incessantly for hours on end. You also lied to me on several occasions when you told me that I could beat up several bouncers at bars. That was completely untrue, and I got stitches and now I have scars on my head to prove it. So goodbye, Cocaine. Take it easy. Artie." When I handed it in, Kevin said, "Well, obviously you're being funny and not taking this seriously. This is not great, Artie. Do it over." It took me about 3 drafts to come up with something sincere enough so Kevin wouldn't think I was making fun of the exercise. I still was, of course, because I still think it's a silly way to make a point. But if it works for some people, I'm not going to fault it. I would have written anything at all at that moment because I was just desperate as hell to get back on TV. Group therapy was a pretty interesting mix of about 15 people. There were girls and guys, older and younger, with 1 or 2 hot chicks in the mix. No matter who was talking, you heard amazing stories. I do a joke in my stand-up based on that, because all I kept thinking as I listened to them was, God, a year ago, this would have been a great fucking party. Now it's just a bunch of self-righteous people telling each other not to do drugs or drink. That's the truth. One of those hot chicks, this beautiful girl with a really nice set of tits, told us how 6 months earlier she used to get so out of her mind drunk that she'd jump on tables, rip her shirt off, and yell and scream for no reason whatsoever. She ended her story by saying, "I'm glad those times are behind me, and I wish all of you would keep from drinking or doing drugs as I have." All I kept thinking was, really? I wish it was 6 months ago. I made the mistake of whispering that to a guy sitting next to me, and we both laughed and got in trouble. I felt like I was back in school trying to get laughs and getting yelled at for it. At the end of my 2 months of rehab, I got the official word from Mad TV that they weren't going to pick up my contract for the next season. I'm convinced it was because the report they got from Honesty House. Because truth be told, I fooled around here and there and didn't finish a few of the steps. Unless it's baseball or comedy, I've never really been much of a team player. But it meant that the Mad TV chapter in my life was officially over. I had gotten fired from Mad TV for my coke problem, and now I had a reputation in Hollywood. But in those 2 years on television, I managed to do enough decent work to make a 5-minute reel of tape that featured a full range of my sketch material. As I finished up my therapy and got myself back together, my agent and manager started sending it out to people so I could get booked for stand-up and other work. Once again, someone was looking out for me because the tape got hits right away. I got called to screen test for 2 network sitcoms. I couldn't really believe it. Being offered screen tests is a big deal because it means you don't have to do the preliminary auditions. I did 5 auditions for Mad TV and was lucky to get that far. Screen test bypassed all of that. It was a message saying that I was good enough to be flown out to LA to audition directly for the casting director, producers, and everyone important. Those calls boosted my confidence astronomically. I started doing a lot more stand-up at all the New York City clubs. The Comic Strip, Stand Up New York, Catch a Rising Star, New York Comedy Club, and Caroline's. Between the comedy and the therapy, I felt like I was getting all of my issues out there and dealing with the shit. I felt ready to screen test for those 2 shows, and I was completely excited about it. I remember sitting down with my mother one day, feeling like I'd crossed a bridge. "Ma, I think I might be back quicker than I thought." She looked at me for a long minute. "You are back, Artie," she said, "but go slowly this time." The therapist in my group sessions thought I was moving along much too quickly, but I thought he was full of shit. In my mind, the only thing keeping me from being me again was staying out of the game. I felt rested and ready to get back into show business. And considering the interest, show business was ready for me. While my agent negotiated my deal for the screen tests, my manager got a call from Norm MacDonald. I had never met Norm before, but I was a big fan of his. I loved his stand-up, and while I was at Mad TV, Dave Herman and I used to imitate all of his best jokes from SNL's Weekend Update. His style and delivery were perfect. In 1997, Norm was the biggest star on Saturday Night Live, literally the face of the show. So when my manager told me that I was asked to audition as the second lead in a buddy comedy starring Norm, I was ecstatic. The script was written by Frank Sebastiano, a brilliant writer who became my collaborator on Beer League, Norm MacDonald, and the great Fred Wolf, a former head writer for Saturday Night Live and one of the funniest guys I've ever met in my life. I belly laughed at a lot of the jokes when I read the script. Norm's voice came right through, and I totally loved his best friend character, Sam McKenna. When I finished it, I called my manager and told him I had to do this movie. It was called Dirty Work. It was a big deal, an MGM feature produced by Robert Simons. For those who don't know, Bobby Simons produced Problem Child, which made a lot of money, as well as all of Adam Sandler's films, Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, and The Wedding Singer. On top of having a huge producer involved, a major studio, plus Norm, the biggest star on SNL, I found that the guy who had signed on to play my character's father in the film was Jack Warden. Hands down, Jack is one of my heroes. Chris Farley was also signed on to play a supporting role, and Don Rickles had a cameo. Chevy Chase had a cameo too. There was even talk that Adam Sandler and Howard Stern might also do cameos. To top it all off, Bob Saget, a guy I admired but never met, was directing. It was a major project, no doubt about it. "They want to test you," Peter, my manager, told me. "We've got to get you on a plane immediately. You're going to fly out there and screen test with Norm in the room. Possibly Bob Simons and Bob Saget, too. They're going to videotape you to show you to the powers that be at MGM. You are going to do it in Bob Saget's office in Santa Monica. He paused for a moment. Artie, you need to tell me if you could do this, and you need to be very honest with me and with yourself. Peter, I said, look at me. I promise you I could do this. There's nothing else I want to do in this world but this. I meant it 100%. He could see it in my eyes. Okay, Artie, then let's do it. When I walked into the Dirty Work audition, I wanted that job more than a hobo wants a steak. If I got it, as far as I was concerned, I would be getting back into the business in the best possible way. This film was going to feature just about all of my heroes in comedy. Working with them was my dream homecoming. I was nervous as hell when I got out to LA because the last time I'd been there, aside from my court appearance, I'd been arrested, high out of my mind, and thrown produce at my agents and producers at a supermarket. So that was on my mind, but I made up for it by preparing well. Bob Saget, Norm MacDonald, and Norm's assistant Laurie Joe, who became one of my favorite people in the whole world, were in the room for my audition. They taped my performance, and I thought I did well, except for the fact that during the whole thing, Norm never got up from the couch. He just lay there the entire time saying things like, "Hey man, thank you for coming out. Good to see ya." What was even more confusing was that Saget was like a hyper kid, jumpy, happy, and enthusiastic the whole time. He was probably as excited as I was because a chance to direct a talented group like that was a big opportunity for him. The next day, Saget, Norm, and Bob Simons called me on a conference call in my hotel room. "So," I said, "how was it?" "Well," Norm said, taking this dramatic pause, "it was great." Then Saget chimed in, "Yes, it was, Artie. You were great." To be honest with you, I had no idea what that meant at all. Maybe they liked it, and they were trying to let me down easy. Maybe they knew about my past and didn't want some kind of freak out on their hands. That was all they told me. Then they hung up. I sat there staring at a wall wondering what the hell they just told me when the phone rang again. "Hey man, it's Norm," he said. "Listen, we have to see some other people, but you did an amazing job." "Well, thanks, man. That means a lot." "We can't say anything for sure yet, but let's just go shoot some pool in Hollywood tonight." We were all in Santa Monica, so they picked me up, and we drove to the pool hall, which is about 30 minutes away on Fairfax and Sunset. Once I got in the car with Norm and Bob, the real meaning of the outing became crystal clear. "So, Artie, we want you to know that we want you in this movie," Norm said. "You were great today, man, and we think you're perfect for the part," Saget said. "Well, I want to do it, there's no question of that," I said. "That's great," Norm said. "There's just one thing. You don't have the greatest track record." "Guys, I will be as good as a second-grade ballerina," I said. "You will not see me doing drugs, and there's nothing I won't do to make sure that if I get this part, I won't lose it." "That's great, Artie," Norm said. "That's what we want to hear, and I think you really mean it." In typical me fashion, I was feeling so good that by the time we got to our destination, I was ready to ruin it. What I'm about to tell you is so embarrassing, but it's the reality of being an addict. We got to the pool hall, we started shooting pool, we had a few drinks, and here's how stupid I got. "So Artie, we know about the drugs," Saget said, eyeing me and my third Jack and Coke. "But how are you with the booze?" "Oh man, fine," I said. "That was never the problem. Just Coke, man. I can drink. It's totally fine. It never got in the way." I'm not sure if they were comforted by that. I doubt it. But as if to prove my retarded point, I started drinking and I started winning at pool. And because of that, after a while, I felt like I had the part, no problem. I got happy. I did about 7 shots of tequila in front of them. There was no one there to come out of the corner and smack me on the head to remind me that I was one step away from getting or losing the part in a movie, so maybe getting brazenly drunk in front of these guys wasn't the best idea. No, I was feeling so confident about my position with them that after I slammed my last shot, I didn't think twice about very obviously asking one of the 4 Mexican guys playing pool next to me if he can get me some cocaine. I'd been kind of talking to the guy for a minute because he recognized me from Mad TV, which in my drunk logic made me think that I was even more valuable in Norm's and Saget's eyes. The coke transaction wouldn't matter to them. Besides, I was so slick they wouldn't even know. "Hey man," I whispered drunkenly to this kid. "So you know me, right? Can you get me some coke? I got money, man." "What?" the kid said. No, no, man. I don't sell coke, man. Oh, yeah? Well, no problem. One look back at Sagan and Norm proved to me that we hadn't been whispering. It didn't help that after he talked to his buddies for a minute, this guy came back to me. It's cool, man, the guy said. I'll give you my number. We'll score for you tomorrow, okay? I was already aware that my drug trafficking wasn't going down unnoticed, but I didn't care. I got the guy's number as Norm and Sagitt watched. They didn't say anything, but they wrapped things up. Norm went home to his place in West Hollywood, and Sagitt drove me back to Santa Monica to my hotel. I was definitely drunk, and they definitely weren't. I got to my room, I ordered myself a cheeseburger from room service, and the next morning I woke up with a beef patty on my chest, half-eaten. I looked over at the clock, it was 9 a.m. In about 10 seconds, the entire evening came back to me. Anyone who's ever been drunk, been dumb, and remembered it the next morning in bed knows what I'm talking about. The depression and disappointment I felt when I realized what I had done washed over me, and it was as overwhelming as my harshest drug withdrawals. I couldn't understand myself at all. I told myself not to act that way, and then I'd done it. And there I was, waking up to my own actions once more. There was a terrace visible through the window, and I thought about jumping off of it. But I promised myself that I'd never do that, or even try to do that again, so I just sat there feeling helpless. I wasn't going to go against two promises I made myself back to back. I started to cry, thinking there was nothing else in the world that I could possibly fuck up in this life. By 11 a.m., I'd been pacing around my hotel room with the shades drawn for 2 hours, wondering whether I should just go for broke and start drinking and doing drugs again until I died, or if I had a chance to rescue this thing. Then the phone rang. I put it on speaker. It was Norm, Sagitt, Bob Simons, and Lori Joe. So, Artie, Norm said, we've been thinking about this, and we talked, and we've got to tell you, you got the part. I didn't believe him at all. Come on, man, this isn't cool, I said. Don't bullshit me. No bullshit, man, really. We start shooting in 2 weeks. Congratulations. I was already pretty wound up, so once my mood changed from anxiety to celebration, I started jumping up and down all by myself in my hotel room. My thoughts and emotions were so conflicted in so many ways. I was in L.A., a city I had a love-hate relationship with. I nailed a screen test for the biggest thing I'd ever done, yet all of my demons had reared their heads the very same night and almost caused me to lose it. I had not, until that night, even thought about doing coke. It was the last thing I wanted to reintroduce myself to on my road back to show business. I looked at this as a victory that I won by luck. I was convinced that those guys hadn't seen me try to score coke, and that they believed me when I told them I could hold my liquor. The first day we started shooting the movie, Norm set me straight. Hey, he said, Sagan and I knew you were trying to score coke that night. Really? It's not like you were quiet about it, man. It was pretty loud in there, and you know, we could have been talking about anything, I thought, I said. Norm just stared at me. Okay, fine, but you still hired me. Look, dude, he said, I don't judge anybody. You're funny. We need you, and I figure that I can keep you in line. I'd never fire you just for that. I felt bad for you that night, but you have to know that I know. You didn't get one past me at all, okay? Thank God Norm is who he is. I owe that man so much. He was so understanding at a time when so many others would have been judgmental hypocrites who wouldn't have dealt with me at all. Everything I have ever done in my career following Mad TV, I owe to Norm MacDonald. He is a great man and a great friend, and I love him. The same goes for Sagitt. He had the patience of a saint with me. And without those two motherfuckers, you would not be reading this book, that's for sure. Once I had officially gotten my role in Dirty Work, my agent turned down my screen test for the network sitcom and used it to my advantage. He told them that I booked an enormous movie with Norm MacDonald, Chris Farley, and Chevy Chase for MGM, and I was going to play Norm's buddy in the film. Hollywood logic is absurd. So, of course, the very same day he turned the network down, my manager, Peter, got a call from the same network and two others who had heard of my rejection of the screen test and were suddenly interested in offering me development deals. They wanted to have meetings as soon as I was done shooting the film. Now, for all those who think there's still easy money to be made in Hollywood, let me be the guy who saves you the effort and the rejection. Those days are gone. This was the tail end of a period in TV land when everyone was feeling good because the economy in general was strong, so studio executives were handing out very lucrative development deals to everyone, even to people like me. 2 weeks later, I showed up to the Dirty Work set in Toronto, walking on air because I knew that I was fucking back. After we were done shooting the movie, I was set to fly back to LA and meet every single network that mattered. They'd all probably try to outbid each other, and in the end, I'd walk away with several $100,000 for a development deal from one of them. All because I said no to a TV show screen test, which I've been able to reject because of this movie. A movie that starred everyone I could ever hope to work with. Damn, my life was good. So good that I forgot about the month and a half that I had left in my program back at Honesty House. Once I'd gotten a degree of affirmation in the show business world, suddenly my work there was meaningless. I told them that I booked a movie and had to leave in a week. I said it as if I made complete sense. Getting work again meant I was well. My group leader, Kevin, wasn't buying that at all. So what? You think you can walk out of here and you'll be fine just because you have a job? He said right to my face. No way, Artie. I'm not gonna give my consent. You think you're ready for that? Yeah, I do, I said. I'm ready to work. What do you want me to do? Fucking stay around here forever? This is bullshit. I'm gonna work. You're not ready for that at all. I was ready to scream at the guy all day until he believed that I was fit for society and ready to work. Unfortunately for me, there was a loophole in my MGM contract that said if I didn't get a bill of approval for my rehab, they could turn me down without question. I was looking at freedom. I was looking at my rebirth, and this guy Kevin was keeping it from me. There was only one thing to do. It was time for a little New Jersey hand greasing. I got myself a meeting with the president of the place. Listen, I said, what can I do here? I have to do this movie. Well, Artie, we want you to do well. We have nothing but your best interests in mind, the president said. We love you, and we want to give you a good report and a chance to get back to work. Yeah, I know, I said, and I've learned about myself and all that. And you know what? All I want is to stay clean and sober. But the thing is, I really need to do this movie or else I really won't reach my potential. Well, you've been good so far, and you've come a long way. I know I have, and I know I'm not exactly done yet, but I've got to do this now, and I could use your support. I know we have confidence in you, and a donation would not hurt your case at all. Really? Really, we can always use funds from private donors. I called my mother and asked her how much I had left in my savings account. There wasn't much, just a few grand. So I made a check out to Honesty House for $1,500 and swore to them that I'd plug them on every talk show I'd ever get on. They went for it, and the next day they sent a letter to the powers that be at MGM that Artie had completed rehab with a clean bill of health. Yeah, it's all true. And you know what? Salud. Fuck it all. I could say all this without threat of litigation because Honesty House closed down years ago. Too bad. There's more than a few celebrities who could use a rehab facility where it's possible to buy a clean slate on the way out. I had a few days at home in Union before I flew out to Toronto. The night before I left, Bob Saget called and was beyond honest with me. Listen, man, we're all excited to have you on board, he said. But I'm the one who's been elected to say this to you. Okay. Whatever you do, if you're doing coke, pot, anything, if you're doing coke, don't bring it up there to Toronto, okay? Because if you do, and you get caught, you'll throw all this away. Bob, I'm not gonna... Listen, you don't have to tell me, okay? I just want to be really clear. We have given you a second chance. Don't try to take drugs across the border, and don't try to score drugs in Canada. If you're caught, Artie, you don't get it. You won't be the only one in trouble. If you fuck up, you'll shut down the whole fucking movie. Bob, that's the last thing I want to do, believe me. Yeah, I believe you. But we know you've had trouble with the authorities, and we know you like drugs. If you shut down this fucking movie because you go across the border to score drugs, we will all be fucked. Do you understand? Yeah, I understand. If you don't do that, we'll be fine. We'll make a great movie. Okay? I promise you, I will never do that. I told him so with the same conviction I'd expressed 10 minutes before I tried to score coke off those Mexican kids. In any case, he believed me. Okay, Artie, we'll see you up in Toronto. The cast did rehearsals for 5 days at the Four Seasons Hotel. And the first night after we were done, me and Norm and his assistant Lori Jo went to shoot pool at a place on Yonge Street. When you sign on to do a movie for 2 months, where you'll play a second lead alongside someone, it's like going away to boot camp with them. You're either going to end up loving your co-star or hating them. From the beginning, I knew that me and Norm were going to love each other like brothers because we had at least one of the same vices. We both love gambling. I found that out the very first night I shot pool with the guy who technically had given me the job and could definitely have gotten me fired in a heartbeat. No one but a healthy gambler would be totally fine with his lesser-billed co-star walking away with $2,500 of his money after a game of nine ball. He eventually paid up in Canadian dollars. The thing about Canadian money is that, to an American, it doesn't look like real money. I felt that way during the entire Dirty Work shoot. We get our per diems, which is supposed to cover your daily expenses, and we'd hang out in all the bars and strip clubs on Yonge Street, and it made whatever we did much more fun, because in my mind, I wasn't spending real money, so none of what we did meant anything. I'd go get blowjobs from strippers when I felt like it, I'd buy drinks for everyone in sight, and when I got back to my room, whatever I had left was play money for tomorrow. Toronto was a funny place. One night I got this chick back to my room. I thought I'd been smooth and she responded to my charm, but that wasn't the case. She was a hooker. She caught me off guard, and once we had done it, she asked me for money. I was so embarrassed that I acted like I knew she was a hooker the whole time. I gave her a wad of that Canadian funny money, and when I did the math, I realized that I'd given the equivalent of about $1,000. Essentially, I got a hooker who I thought just liked me to give me an unbelievably overpriced blowjob. But you know what? She was hot. She really was. So fuck you. It was Canadian money anyway. There was no pictures of presidents to stare you down. There was shit like geese and bacon looking back at you from a backdrop of weird Monopoly paper. It didn't matter anyway because I won $2,500 off of Norm that night. This all happened the first night I was there, by the way. My agent called me the next morning. "So how's it going?" "Pretty good, man," I said. "I won $2,500 off Norm playing pool." "What? You're gonna get fired," he said. "Listen to me. You lose to him from now on. You lose shooting pool." "Fuck that, man," I said. "When I win, I win. And Norm is not that kind of guy. He'll be more mad if I lose on purpose." "Fuck you, Artie. Lose to him from now on, you hear me?" The 2 months it took for us to shoot Dirty Work were arguably two of the most enjoyable months of my life. I was back. Coke was out of my life for good, and I just knew it. My mother and sister came up to visit me over Labor Day weekend, and everyone treated them really nicely. It seemed like every week a new actor showed up to shoot their part, and I loved all of it. Chevy Chase came up the first week, and one night me, Norm, Lori Jo, and Chevy Chase went to shoot pool. We were drinking, doing shots, and everyone but Chevy and I left early, so I got to hang out with him for 2 hours shooting pool. He could not have been a cooler guy, and I'm so glad because I idolized him for years. Plenty of people have told me that Chevy is a pain in the ass, but he was unbelievably nice to me. We had an in-depth conversation, and I learned stuff from him about how to do physical comedy that no one else could have taught me. He told me what he had planned for the supporting role, and none of the physical stuff he had in mind was in the script at all. He'd come up with it, and that was what made his appearance so good. Unfortunately, everything he didn't actually make it into the movie. That's another story altogether, but trust me when I tell you that he was amazing to watch in rehearsal. More important to me as a comic, I got to grill Chevy about John Belushi in the early Saturday Night Live days, and he answered my questions with not a stitch of attitude. He was brutally honest about all of it. And as a fan and a comedian, I have to say there's no greater gift the guy could have given me. At the end of the night, we walked back to our hotel like two high school buddies. I couldn't believe that I was lucky enough to live that moment. After Chevy left, Jack Warden came up to do 10 days of shooting. Jack fucking Warden is from Newark, New Jersey, like my family. He played my father in a movie, and on the set he became a father figure to me. When I told him my father was from Newark, he said, "I bet your father was a fighter. Guys from Newark are fighters." He couldn't have been more right. And then, as if things couldn't get better, Don Rickles shows up for his one day of shooting. One of my great, unforgettable moments in show business. Don's first day shooting was my first day shooting too, and at that moment, I wasn't sure I was going to make it to the end of this movie. I heard that if you're gonna get fired, it usually happens in the first 2 weeks because there's still time to reshoot everything. After the first 2 weeks, you're home free. It costs more to get rid of you than to keep you. So my first take on a film that I've gotten despite my solicitation of cocaine from Mexicans at a pool hall involved Don Rickles berating me. Norm and I played loser ushers at a movie theater, and Don's character was our boss. The scene opens with him telling us just how awful we are. Besides how great it was to just meet a fucking legend like Rickles, he also happened to be incredibly nice. I even got him to insult me on camera and then say hi to my mother. He showed up at 6 a.m. for an 18-hour day. I think they were paying him something like $100,000 a day, so obviously they wanted to get his scenes done in that one long day. And that's what we did from 6 a.m. until midnight, and the whole time Don was on fire. The man is a ball of energy. Norm, Sagan, and I were standing around the food service table early in the morning when Don walked up. You know, before I left Hollywood the other day, I saw Marty Scorsese, he said. I told him, Marty, I'm going to Toronto. Bob Saget is directing a film. And the man grabbed his chest. We all started to laugh, but Don wasn't done. What are you doing here, Saget? Go back to L.A. A cat pissed itself on America's Funniest Home Videos. They need you to direct him. Rolling into our first scene, Bob didn't even try to ask Don to follow the lines in the script. He just asked him to insult Norm and me. The two of us were dressed like goofy movie theater employees in stiff shirts and stupid bow ties, standing next to each other like prisoners in front of a firing squad. Saget said, action! And Rickles came right up to me and said, look at you. Look at you, you baby gorilla. I cracked up, out loud, as if this was the first and best joke I've ever heard in my life. Because you know what? It kinda was. Everyone else on the set laughed too. And the take was blown, as they like to say on movie sets. That was great, Don, Saget said, trying to control himself. Okay, let's do it again. Rickles came up to me again and said it again. Look at you, you baby gorilla. And once again, I died laughing. As I lost it again, I decided that I was probably going to get fired, but I was having so much fun that I didn't give a shit. If laughing at Rickles gets me kicked off a picture, I'd be happy to go out like that. Saget came up to me. Artie, you gotta get it together. Get it together? I was still gasping for air. The man is a legend. He's in my face, 2 inches from me, saying the funniest shit ever. I may never stop laughing for the rest of my life. It took about 20 takes to get those two lines on film. I'm not kidding. Eventually I was able to get through a take where Rickles called me a baby gorilla. But if you watch Dirty Work, you'll see that Norm is laughing. They did what they could to cut around it, but it was hopeless. So once we got that first line, Rickles moved on, because he was far from done with me. You know, he said, Baskin Robbins called and said you ate them down to only 5 flavors, you fat pig. He then put his face by my stomach and said, having a good time in there, ice cream? You dancing around? None of us knew that was coming either, and we couldn't do anything but laugh. 10 or 20 takes later, again, we finally got one take where we managed to stifle our hysteria long enough for him to deliver that second bit. Finally, Rickles was done with my half of his insult tirade. We had probably 2 usable takes, and I'm using the word usable loosely. Then he moved on to Norm, and those insults were even funnier, mostly because for the first 10 takes, Rickles insulted him not as his character Mitch, but as Norm MacDonald. So tell me, how did you get a movie? Rickles said. Cut, Saget said. Don, very funny, but you cannot insult Norm as Norm. His name is Mitch in the movie. We can't use that take if you insult him as Norm MacDonald. Fine, Rickles said, eyeballing Saget with that shifty look of his. Okay, Bob, that's fine. I understand what you're saying to me. Okay, Saget said, from the top. Action. Rickles walked right up to Norm and said, Norm? Who wrote these jokes? This script is awful. Cut! Saget was laughing hysterically. Done. Do not insult the script either. We can't use takes where you insult the script. Okay, Bob, sorry about that. I must have gotten ahead of myself. This went on for what felt like 2 of the best days of my life, until finally we got through the scene, which is probably the funniest scene in the whole fucking movie. And so a baby gorilla was born. After Rickles graced us with the insults, Chris Farley showed up for a week. Now that guy, I'd heard everything there was to hear about him. I thought he was just the most hilariously funny man alive. And meeting him changed nothing. Chris Farley remains one of the funniest comics ever to have lived, as far as I'm concerned. I'm lucky to have had that 1 week to get to know him. I only saw him once more after that shoot in October 1997, a month and a half before he died, when he hosted Saturday Night Live. I went to the taping, and then I went to the after party, and it was obvious that Chris was hurting. He was back on blow, drinking and doing everything else in sight. I didn't know him very well, but Norm loved him dearly and was very concerned about him. For that week of the shoot, though, I got to sit there and piss myself laughing at him every day on the set. Dirty Work is Chris's last movie. In it, he plays a guy called Jimmy No-Nose, whose nose was bitten off by a Saigon whore. That was his entire storyline. It wasn't much, but Chris made it shine. Every day that week, I had lunch in Norm's trailer, where all the famous guys coming through to do cameos would hang out. From Chevy Chase to Adam Sandler to Jack Warden to the great John Goodman, we'd all have lunch together and just bullshit. I was in fucking heaven. The week that Farley was up there, man, I don't think I ever laughed so hard in my life. He would come in with his lunch and just start telling stories, acting stuff out while eating lunch, just like the rest of us. Doing something simple like eating ice cream became an opportunity for Chris. Anything he did was a chance to do all these different characters. You could tell that he truly loved making people laugh. The fucking guy had such a kind way about him, too. He treated me very nicely because I think he could just tell how intimidated and in awe of him I was. It's not like it was hard for me to hang out with him. What was hard was not being able to tell him everything I wanted to say. It didn't take much for me to see that Chris was fucked up. At that point, his management, Brillstein Gray, had hired a guy to watch him and keep him out of trouble, like Belushi used to have. The guy's specific job was to keep Chris Farley off dope. From what I saw, that guy shouldn't have gotten a recommendation letter because it was clear that Farley knew how to ditch him. That's pure speculation, of course, because I never actually saw Chris take drugs. To this day, I can only dream of being as funny as Chris fucking Farley. Rest in fucking peace, my brother. If you get the chance to see Dirty Work, see it for Chris. You need no other reason. Every time he's on screen, every line, every joke out of his mouth is a hit out of the park. And there are outtakes running over the end credits that are priceless. There's a great one with Norman Farley doing this one scene that took him like a half a day to shoot because Norm could not stop laughing. It was hopeless. In the outtakes, you could just see how much Chris and Norm liked each other and how much joy Chris was getting out of making Norm laugh like that. It's touching and it's sad and it's very real. When he died in December 1997, I was out in L.A., running late, trying to catch my plane back to Jersey for Christmas, when my manager called me to tell me the news. I barely even knew Chris, but it felt like a punch in the stomach. "Are you kidding me?" I said. "I wish I was," my manager said. "You can guess what it was. He was with a hooker, and they found him dead of coke and a heroin overdose in his condo in Chicago." I was really affected by it, not only because of the eerie similarities to the death of his hero, John Belushi. Both of them died in the company of a shady woman and from the same style of overdose, a speedball. They both died at 33. It was an awful turn of events, and it was a huge wake-up call to me. I had just turned 30. Let me tell you, more than therapy, more than rehab, more than almost losing everything I'd worked for, Chris Farley's death kept me off of coke. I remember wandering into an airport bar to catch the announcement on the news and staring at the years 1964 to 1997 listed under his face. I couldn't believe it. I'd just done a movie with him, and he was so vibrant and so alive, and drugs took that all away from him. I got the message all right. I stayed clean and enjoyed a very productive period in my life after that. The other great I got to meet on the Dirty Work set was Adam Sandler, who was only up there for 1 day. Because of that, I didn't get to spend as much time as I would have liked with Rebecca Romijn. She hadn't yet added the Stamos to that name of hers, but he was there too because they're already dating. Anyway, Sandler was someone I wanted to meet ever since his early bits on SNL. He was always great in a sketch, and his comedy albums were amazing. I'd seen Billy Madison multiple times, and it was what I did between walking around to commercial audition in New York City and doing stand-up that night. I'd kill time in theaters and watch his movie. Adam was really cool, and it was fun to meet him. I learned an important lesson doing Dirty Work. If you're ever given the chance to work with someone who is smarter and funnier than you, without question, do it. It will make you better at whatever you do. Just about everyone involved with Dirty Work was smarter and funnier than me. So it was like fucking comedy school for me. Frank Sebastiano was younger and smarter and funnier than me. Norm is very obviously smarter and funnier than me. The comedy writer Fred Wolf is smarter and funnier too. Chris Farley was much funnier, and okay, I'll give you smarter too. And Adam Sandler is definitely smarter and funnier. So if you look at it constructively, there was no way I wasn't coming out of this experience better at my job. Another treat for me on Dirty Work was meeting the legendary comedy writer Jim Downey, who did his bit part in Dirty Work as he had in Billy Madison. After Dirty Work, I became good friends with Jim and we would have dinner from time to time. One night the following April, he invited me to watch the NCAA semifinals with him and one of his friends. This friend was staying in a brand new hip hotel called the Soho Grand. I had no idea until we got to the room that Jim's friend was Bill Murray. Bill was in town shooting a film and was staying there with his two sons. Bill is one of my absolute heroes, so I couldn't even believe I was watching basketball with him. There were a couple of impressions and things I would do that made Downey laugh, which was thrilling to me to get a great comedy writer like Jim to laugh. Jim asked me to do that for Bill Murray that night, and I blew it. I completely bombed in front of Bill Murray. Downey enjoys bringing that up. On Dirty Work, I felt like I'd been juicing. In just 2 months, I'd gotten funnier than I deserved to be. I learned a ton of stuff about jokes and how to write them. And I got a more enlightened sense of what was an obvious hacky joke and what wasn't. I took that stuff seriously and it inspired me to get out there and write and perform new material. When Dirty Work wrapped, a great time in my life began. The networks and tons of production companies wanted to meet me. God bless them and God bless my agents, Jennifer Craig and James Dixon at William Morris, and my manager, Peter Principato, all of whom worked it perfectly. Right from the film set, I flew to LA for meetings with Fox, NBC, ABC, UPN, and loads of production companies those corporations owned, as well as a few others. I was full of amazing stories from the set about working with all these comedy legends, so I destroyed in every fucking meeting. I met with Warren Littlefield, the head of NBC at the time, Peter Roth, then the president of Fox, and other power players. Those meetings were tough because there was pressure to perform. My representatives discussed business, but I was there to shine. The story that came in most handy about the star-studded set I just flown in from was the Baby Gorilla story. I repeated it to every network executive I hoped would give me money. By the time it surfaced on the Stern Show, it was road-tested and in great shape. In the end, I got a development deal that resulted from a bidding war. Every single network, all five of them, made offers. William Morris and my manager played them against each other brilliantly, working them up from an offer of $250,000 to $750,000. I signed a development deal with the Fox TV network and the film production company 20th Century Fox, and my first check was for $250,000. It arrived just before Christmas 1997, and I immediately took it home and started up my corporation, Too Fat to Fish, Inc. I paid every one of my mother's bills, I paid off the mortgage on our family house, I got her out of debt, and we finally started to breathe easy for a change. I put the rest in the bank and began to meet writers to start developing things. In 8 months, I'd gone from a deep depression, living in my mother's basement, preparing myself to start driving a cab again, to having shot a movie for MGM and having a development deal to come up with a film or TV show of my own on a major network. I got a new car, my mom got a new car, and it was finally happy times once more. It had been ages. That Christmas, I was so grateful for everything that had happened. I'd made some permanent changes. I wasn't done with drugs, but I was done with coke. Thank God. Because that guy cocaine, take it from me, is the biggest devil out there. I'm not mad at him anymore. He was a fun guy to hang with, aside from the part where he almost killed me and made my life complete chaos. My development deal was very lucrative because I got paid the whole $750,000. Normally, you have three chances to accept a showrunner or executive producer the studio offers you to help develop an idea. If you turn them down, you only get half the money. If you agree on a showrunner or executive producer and shoot a pilot, whether or not the pilot gets picked up, you get paid all the money. There's a time limit on all this, of course, And toward the end of my deal, around February 1998, Fox started to panic because they'd give me all this money and hadn't made an offer on one thing I'd pitched. I wasn't submitting scripts and didn't have too much that I was working on, but I was cashing multiple six-figure checks. I was so antsy to get something moving that I went to LA for the first couple of months of 98 just so I wouldn't miss any emergency meetings with my writer. For 2.5 months, I lived at the Bellage Hotel in Hollywood, right off of Sunset. I hung out at the Viper Room every night and saw some cool bands. I walked over to Duke's on Sunset, stopped by the Whiskey A Go-Go. I drove around in a rented Mustang convertible and lived in a hotel and spent 10 G's in 2 months. Typical me. It was important for me to be happy in L.A. trying to make stuff happen. I also spent that time doing stand-up and got familiar with L.A. venues like the Laugh Factory and the Comedy Store. I hung out a lot with Norm Macdonald, who by then had been famously fired from Saturday Night Live. Norm had been doing Weekend Update for 4 years, and without warning, was fired by executive Don Ohlmeyer because he wasn't funny. The rumor was that Ohlmeyer didn't like how much Norm made fun of his good friend O.J. Simpson, but that's probably not true because when Norm was replaced by Colin Quinn, Colin laid into O.J. just as hard. Lorne Michaels never went to bat for Norm, and for a while it looked like NBC was going to boycott any promotion of Dirty Work on the network. Even if they had, the appearances Norm got on shows like Letterman made up for all of that. Letterman is legendary for hating television executives, so he sided with Norm. He said on the air that he met Ohlmeyer, who claimed to be a creative type, but Ohlmeyer wasn't even creative enough to create gas. Norm then told Dave about how he got fired. He walked in and Don said, "Norm, I've got some bad news. You're fired." "Oh, wow. That is bad news," Norm said. "That's horrible. Why am I fired?" "Because you're not funny." "Oh, my God, that's worse. I'm not funny. I'm in comedy. I'll never get another job." Letterman, of course, loved that story. And when Norm and I wanted to promote the movie on the Stern Show, he told the story again. It's a classic. Anyway, after a few months of cash and checks and not getting any ideas to the network, they finally hooked me up with this writer, Sam Cass, who used to work on Seinfeld. He had a script where I'd play a doorman at a hotel, and I liked it a lot. But the network made the poor guy rewrite the script practically overnight since pilot season was almost over. The script was not ready to be shot, but the network execs were afraid they were going to lose the money they were giving me. They rushed it through, we rushed casting, we rushed everything. The week we actually shot the pilot, I knew it was going to be a disaster. I didn't know what I would do if the network actually picked it up. I hated the result and I hated my performance in it so much that the prospect of doing it for any length of time made me want to leap off a building. I'd be back into the frying pan with another show I didn't like and I was afraid that I was going to relapse. The night we shot this thing could not have gone worse. The taping went from 7 p.m. to 4 in the morning. The cast turned out to be really good. Luis Guzman, a great character actor who's been in a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson movies, played a fell doorman. Luis really wanted the show to get picked up, and despite my reservations, in a way so did I, because I would have been making 55 grand a week with a couple of points on the back end, but there was no way it was going to get picked up. It wasn't Sam Cass's fault. It wasn't anyone who worked on its fault. It was a mess because the network let it go too long and then rushed it through. That was April 1998, and the pilot was called The King of New York. I played a doorman who worked at a hotel like the Plaza, the kind of doorman who can get you anything. Tickets to a show or a game, whatever the hell you need. I was a fast-talking guy, which I liked. The script was just not there. We shot our pilot the very same season that they shot The King of Queens, which was coincidental because that show has a similar premise. That year, one king went on to major success, and the other king did not. But you know what? I got the whole $750,000 because I shot a pilot. Once again, someone upstairs was looking out for me. In the end, I learned a ton about what not to do with a development deal. I had said yes to the script even though I knew it was not ready because I felt guilty taking money from these network people for doing nothing. But that was stupid. If the network couldn't get the script up to par in time, it was their problem, not mine. My mistake was agreeing to something I didn't really believe in. I got my last check for 250 grand a few weeks after that, and I still couldn't believe it. As is the case with my life, when stuff goes good, it goes great. When I got out of that first development deal, my agents immediately got me a holding deal about a week later with NBC. NBC wanted to cast me in something, so they paid me $350,000 to keep me from being picked up by another network. The first check from them was for $150,000. "Artie, what do you have to do for this money?" my mother, being old-fashioned, asked me when I handed it to her to deposit in the corporate account. "What do you do for them? Do you have to run drugs from Mexico or guns to Cuba?" "No, Ma, even worse," I said. "I have to be on TV. This is showbiz." The terms of the holding deal stated that NBC intended to cast me in a supporting role in a script that they had under development. And until they did, I couldn't take any other TV acting work. Like I said, when it rains, it pours. I also got an audition for a romantic comedy called Lost and Found, starring David Spade and Martin Sheen, and this gorgeous French actress, Sophie Marceau. I had two great auditions for the director, Jeff Pollock, and then I met Spade at the screen test and I killed it. Norm is a friend of Spade, so he put in a good word, and in the end, that's probably what got me the part, which was like the third lead of the film. Spade was hilarious, and Martin Sheen was great. I enjoyed another 2 months with a ton of per diem money. Plus, we shot in L.A., so I was able to do stand-up there when I had time. I opened for Norm on the road, too. Immediately following Lost and Found, I got cast in The Bachelor, a $30 million New Line Cinema movie with Chris O'Donnell and Renee Zellweger. I played the third lead and got to pal around in that movie with Hal Holbrook, Ed Asner, James Cromwell, and Brooke Shields. Then I shot The Fourth Floor, which I got because the director, Josh Klausner, was a major Mad TV fan and loved the White Mama character. Even though it was a drama, he offered me the part. I did scenes with Juliette Lewis, William Hurt, Shelley Duvall, and the great actor Austin Pendleton. These were major dramatic scenes where I play a superintendent of an apartment building who kind of grunts all the time. It's a murder mystery and you're supposed to think I'm the murderer. Guess what? I'm not. I couldn't believe that Josh Klausner had enough confidence in my abilities to offer me the role without an audition. God bless him. I hope he wasn't disappointed because I gave it my all, and I think it all worked out in the end. Unfortunately, that movie never got a theatrical release. It went straight to HBO. That's fine with me. Dirty Work was my re-entry into show business, but it didn't get its due. It opened on June 12, 1998, and for all intents and purposes, it made about $4 million. The critics panned it, but fuck them. That movie is funny. Adam Sandler loved it, and that really meant a lot to Norm and me, because the approval of someone you respect is more valuable than approval of a bunch of faceless critics. Sandler was right, too. Dirty Work has become a cult hit. I have signed more Dirty Work DVDs than anything else, hands down. I've had more than a few younger kids tell me it's their favorite movie of all time. When they say that, I tell them, you know what? You should really rent The Sting. MGM is the reason why Dirty Work didn't do better. I remember talking to Chevy Chase, who knows the business better than anyone, about how the studio was going to fuck it all up. "Look," he said, "this movie is funny. It's politically incorrect and it's hilarious. Don't let those motherfuckers make it PG-13. For business, after a couple of test screenings, they might beg you to do that. Don't let it happen. Stand firm. Do not let these cocksuckers fuck up what you're doing here. If they make it rated PG-13, they will tear the guts out of it. At least keep the movie funny. Keep it rated R." He knew what he was talking about, all right, because that's exactly what the studio did. Despite our protest, they made it PG-13, and PG-13 movies are, by nature, bland. The R-rated version of Dirty Work was 2 million times funnier. It's totally unfortunate because just a few months later, the Farrelly brothers released a Something About Mary, which was rated R, and that changed everything. MGM also fucked up the release. They were going to bring out Dirty Work in February, which is where they initially put Sandler's movies. But they kept delaying it and delaying it until it came out the same fucking weekend as The Truman Show and a week after Godzilla. To say it was buried is being kind. Fuck it, who cares? Watch it now. You'll see how it would have been so much better, and you'll still like it. As far as my life goes, I became friends with the great Norm MacDonald, Frank Sebastiano, Fred Wolf, Jim Downey, Bob Saget, and a bunch of guys I love. I got to be in the last movie Chris Farley ever made. It was an honor just to meet the guy for a little while, and I would have done it just for that. Dirty Work also got me a couple more movies in a row, and $1.1 million worth of development deals. It led to everything for me, that movie. If you're a fan of mine, you already know that when Norm was out promoting Dirty Work, he brought me along with him to the Howard Stern Show in 1998. Here's how he introduced me. "You love Artie, Howard," Norm said on the air as I sat next to him in the studio. "He got kicked off of Mad TV for cocaine." I was so pissed at him. I thought he fucked me over. What did I know? That was the biggest favor he could have ever done. I had no choice but to tell the whole story of how I got arrested and fired from the show in all its glory, and Howard, of course, loved it. 2 years later, when I did the Norm show, Norm and I did the Stern show a few more times, 4 appearances in all. When Jackie Martling left the Stern show in 2001, a bunch of comics descended like a pack of hyenas trying to get his seat while the thing was still warm. I'm a lucky motherfucker. I got in there only because they remember me coming in with Norm. Tell you the truth, I don't know what Howard saw in me. Yeah, sure, whatever, I know I'm funny. If I weren't funny, Norm and Saget wouldn't have given me a chance. But Howard saw something else in me. Some days I think he saw the biggest fuck-up he'd ever taken under his wing, and that's saying a lot. Other days I think he saw the right guy to round out that perfect chemistry that he and Fred and Robin and Gary have made into the most unlikely, undeniable success story in broadcasting history. In the end, on whatever day, however he feels, I just hope Howard sees me for what I am, the fan who won the lottery. Heroin, it's better for your liver. Let me tell you, living your life on the air in front of 8 million listeners who pay attention to every single thing you do every single day is pretty fucking strange. I mean, I'm a comic. I'm all for using things from my fucked up life to get laughs and, I hope, make people feel better in the process. But being under a microscope for 5 hours each morning, and I hate the morning, on the Howard Stern Show, is something that no one but Howard, Fred, Robin, Gary, and everyone else who's ever been a regular understands. It's strange because the fans really do care in their way. They're really a part of your life. They're like relatives who keep tabs on you. But for someone like me, who also likes his privacy, that's both a blessing and a curse. I don't need a bunch of people, let alone an audience, inserting themselves into my life. My mother and sister are enough. Fuck, I am enough. I drive myself pretty crazy worrying about all my life on my own. Not to mention that nothing gets by Howard. This story was not part of the original plan for this book, but I don't like to disappoint, and this whole period of my life seems to fascinate fans of the show. So this one is for anyone who could easily hold their own at a superfan roundtable. This is a story about the time in my life when I was lying to everyone. My family, myself, everyone at Howard. I've been doing heroin behind everyone's back for a while. I wanted to kick it, but I was on some powerful drugs and I wasn't acting right. I told everyone on the air that I was drunk. I made it sound as if I was on a bender. But there was much more going on than that. I got into this mess innocently enough. I got addicted to prescription pills, just like any honest, average, hard-working American. And like the average health insurance-enabled pill popper in this country, I got into that shit because I worked too hard. In December 2004, I put a DVD of my stand-up out called It's the Whiskey Talkin' and sold it on my website. A distributor put it out for general release in stores in February 2005. That DVD was the result of a long year and a half of gigs, during which time I perfected my act, taking it to a whole new level. To support the DVD release, I committed to 6 more months of gigs and signings in cities all around the country. That was ambitious. I'd do the Stern Show from Monday to Friday, then Friday and Saturday night stand-up shows with an afternoon signing on Saturday. If we were in, say, Buffalo, I'd go to Coconuts, FYE, or Tower in the late afternoon, stay there until it closed or I ran out of DVDs, do a gig that night, then fly back on Sunday. The next morning, I'd be back on the air for another week. It was an insane schedule, but I figured that I could handle it for 6 months. At the end of it, I would have sold as many DVDs as I could, and then I'd be able to relax all summer. It didn't work out that way. Another blessing turned into a sort of curse. Back in 2001, I started writing a script called Beer League with Frank Sebastiano, who wrote Dirty Work and was a writer on The Norm Show. He'd also won a couple of Emmys for SNL and The Chris Rock Show. It felt like a perfect match. He's a real funny Italian kid from New Jersey who'd also played softball. I had a vision for this film, So in 2000, I put 50 grand into making a 17-minute short that was brilliantly directed by my friend Michael Ruane. I wrote it myself and called it Game Day. And we put it on It's the Whiskey Talking DVD as an extra. We shot it on 35mm film and it looked really good. It showcased my abilities as an actor, and I was really happy about that. I got Frank interested in the short, and we worked on it together over time and had a full-length script by 2002. Once it was done, we made a pledge. We promised each other that should this movie ever get made, we would compromise nothing, no matter what. We agreed to stay true to our original vision and swore that if we couldn't find the right investors, we wouldn't do it at all. Most important, after the mess the studio made of Dirty Work, we were filming it as an R-rated comedy, no questions asked. If there was one single joke that we'd love, but the investors or the studio wanted to take out of the script, then fuck it, the deal was off. Down to the joke, that's how we agreed to do this thing. It was a passion project, not a necessity, because we both had jobs that paid well and we didn't need the money. We met with a lot of money people between 2002 and 2004, and no one was the right fit. Finally, a company called Crush came to us promising to deliver $2.5 million. They were the first to say they wouldn't change a thing and would grant us, without question, full creative control. All they cared about was getting me to agree in writing that I promote the movie on the air. In the blink of an eye, Beer League was set up to be made, and soon enough it was scheduled to be shot in July of 2005. Just when I hoped to be relaxing after that six-month DVD promotional tour. I do my last gig and signing in Chicago on June 4th, and we'd start shooting Beer League on the July 4th weekend. I wasn't happy about the situation, but I was getting to make the movie I wanted. What could I do? I looked at it this way. I'd kill myself this one year, just break my ass, live through it, and have a fuck of a lot to show for it afterward. This whole Beer League thing came with a lot of stress for me, aside from the pressure of starring in a film that I wanted to make. First off, the company who secured the money was getting millions from hedge funds all over the place and just handing it to us. It wasn't a studio full of experienced movie industry veterans behind the funding. It was just a group of guys and us. I didn't want to let anybody down. The second difficult thing was asking Howard for a few weeks off. I knew he wasn't going to like it because Howard values loyalty to the show above all. He's not a total dictator about it, but the show has to come first. The filming of Private Parts was designed entirely around his radio schedule. They built an entire fucking apartment for Howard at Silver Cup Studios in Long Island City so he could live there, shoot all night, and get to the show on time. Obviously, that was fucking impossible on our budget unless I planned to sleep on a cement block in a parking lot. I had a clause in my contract with the show that I could take some time off whenever I wanted, and I'd done it before to shoot films like Old School and Elf, and to take some meetings in L.A. A couple of days here and there were fine with Howard, but a shooting schedule that called for 3 weeks off since I was in every scene was something else. I kept putting off that conversation because I was worried that Howard would say no. If he did, we had real problems, because from the minute the guys at Crush said it was a go, Frank and I got right into pre-production and casting meetings and working on the script, all while fulfilling our commitments. At the time, Frank was a writer on Letterman, so it's not like he was sitting at home playing solitaire. That Frank had done it the right way and had already gotten clearance for a three-week break from Letterman failed to inspire confidence in me. If you've listened this far, you already know that's not one of my strengths. I've been drinking heavily on the road, trying to stay away from the coke, but I was also able to get myself back to work on Monday to do the show. Usually I'd sleep off the weekend on Monday night, and by Tuesday morning I'd be fine. I've always had trouble getting to sleep early for the Stern show, and doing gigs on the weekends with the late hours and travel really fucked me up. After a gig, I found it almost impossible to get to sleep, even when I went right back to my hotel room. I'm not one for travel and hotels anyway. Some people love the road. I really don't. So to get to sleep and to make the experience more pleasurable overall, I started to take a lot of painkillers. Stress loves painkillers. Take it from me. Comedy clubs are just one big medicine chest, too. There's always a lot of Vicodin, Percodan, Percocet, Valium, and whatever else is going around. I gave myself a pill allowance to get through to plane rides and sleeping in shitty hotels, and that's how it started. But with my addictive personality, it quickly got crazier and crazier. Soon I was washing down whatever I can get my hands on with Jack Daniels, thinking it was under control and that there was a reason for doing it. After a month or so, I started taking pills during a regular work week, which led me right into the weekend again, until before I knew it, I was taking like 20 painkillers a day. The most that I ever took is probably about 50 10-milligram Vicodin in one day. They were my daily vitamins. With drinking on top of that, my liver was wounded like a Civil War soldier. I knew that I would have to take a blood test to get insurance for Beer League, and I figured the results were going to be as toxic as Chernobyl. I had to get a complete physical too, and I couldn't imagine that a doctor was going to find me fit enough to carry my own bags to an airport. I put all of it off until finally, in early March, when my back was against a wall, I went for it at the end of a Friday show. Howard was not happy. As always, though, he was cool about it. "Art, you mean a lot to the show, and I'd rather have you here for those 3 weeks," he said. "But you do whatever you have to do, and I'll support it."